Welcome to Trial Lawyer View, a podcast for and about trial lawyers. We will tell the stories about trial lawyers who go to battle every day in courtrooms throughout the United States for injury victims. This is about their stories and their practices. Hello, everyone. I'm Jason Lazarus, your host for Trial Lawyer View. Thank you for tuning in today for another episode. Trial Lawyer View is brought to you by Synergy Settlement Services. In full disclosure, I'm not a professional podcaster. Instead, my day job is Chief Executive Officer of Synergy Settlement Services. Synergy allows trial lawyers to focus on what they do best by handling the difficult issues that arise at settlement, like troublesome lien resolution issues, Medicare secondary payer compliance, government benefit preservation techniques, and complex settlement planning. Joining me today on Trial Lawyer View is Tom Fair. Tom's an award-winning personal injury and product liability trial lawyer. Tom's the founder and CEO of the Torrance-based law firm Fair Law, APC. His firm practice focuses on representing people who've been seriously injured, with an emphasis on brain, spine, and catastrophic injury cases. Tom focuses on personal injury and product liability law, although he's going to talk a little bit about some other areas that they handle as well. At just 39 years old, he has tried over 45 jury trials to verdict and obtained more than $100 million for his clients with multiple seven and eight figure verdicts. He is known for his passion for trying cases and being an advocate for the people, and has been honored with KLA's Rising Star Award in 2018. OCTLA's Young Gun Award in 2017 and CAOC's Street Fighter Award in 2016. Those acronyms give me a hard time sometimes. He's given lectures, presentations, and workshops on trying cases throughout the country for numerous organizations, including CALA, CAOC, OCTLA, CASD, TBI Med Legal, and Trial Lawyers University. Tom graduated from UC Santa Cruz with a BA in poli-sci, philosophy, and psychology, studied at University of Cambridge in the UK, and thereafter obtained his Juris Doctorate degree from Pepperdine University School of Law. Tom, welcome to Trial Lawyer Review. Great to be here with you today. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
So before getting into all the law stuff, there was something that caught my eye about the time that you spent studying in Cambridge. It mentioned study of international politics, world history, and counterintelligence. How did you get interested in all that?
It's a mouthful, right? I've always been fascinated with a lot of different areas of study, and you saw my BA. I got three of them. I almost joke, you have a BA in philosophy, political science, and psychology, and three BAs is one BS. College was sort of an amazing time for me. It was a time where I really fell in love with academia and studying all sorts of things. And there was a time where I thought I might want to get into foreign policy and potentially, be a diplomat or help try to go into sort of war-torn countries and look at sort of post-conflict resolution. And studying in Cambridge, I said, what sort of better place? This is, the UK was a great superpower at some point, and obviously things had changed. And I sort of fell in love with World War I and World War II history. And going to Cambridge, just sort of the culture there and the historical implications of what transpired in the UK around that time was just really fascinating. And you start to learn things about double agents. I mean, there was KGB agents like the Ring of Five that were there at Cambridge and giving information to the KGB about British intel, and it was just fascinating to learn about some of the lives of these people and how they got involved and also how they avoided getting assassinated and being able to do these things. And also, we didn't just have, but 9/11 was still pretty fresh. So it was something I wanted to learn about and just get a better understanding of.
I got my undergraduate degree in psychology, so similar. Although I didn't triple major like you did in undergrad. But I, you know, one of my biggest regrets was not studying at Oxford when I had the opportunity in law school to do that. They had a program at my law school, and I really regret not going over there and doing that. It's an amazing opportunity that my kids have taken advantage of, thankfully, to study abroad, because I really felt like that was such a great thing. It sounds like you had a really incredible experience spending that time there.
Yeah, plus there was a pub on campus. So, but plenty of Guinness, plenty of Guinness.
Yeah. So, when I was doing some research on your background, it indicated that you had worked for a U.S. congressman during college, and I was just curious about that experience and what it was like for you, and if that had any influence on your decision to ultimately go to law school.
Yeah, growing up as an LA native, what sort of Hollywood is to theater, or not theater, but to entertainment and the film industry. Washington, D.C. is that for politics, right? And government. And I really took as full advantage of my college tenure and, having done that exchange program at Cambridge. But I wanted to see what's going on in DC. I wanted to have an idea as to how policies are made, how legislation works. And I've always had an interest in law. I've wanted to be a lawyer since I was 5 years old. And it was actually just, I played ice hockey growing up in LA, so another very you don't hear a lot about that, but it was in the heyday of Wayne Gretzky and whatnot. And there's kids' fathers who would show up to practice wearing suits, and I was like, my dad's a mechanic. And I was like, why are they wearing suits? And there were quite a few dads who were lawyers, and I said, that's what I want to be, even though I had no idea what a lawyer was or what a lawyer did. But my time in Washington was great. I got to see lobbyists in action. I got to see our congressional leaders in action. I got to be part of an office where I really saw how much work the various legislative aides and assistants do to try to get policy done. And they actually put me in responsible they made me responsible for giving tours of the Capitol, which I might have messed up a few times talking about various historical landmarks and things, but I got the hang of it at some point.
Well, so I'm actually flying to DC tomorrow for actually a little bit of legislative work. I'm the president of the National Trade Association for people that do settlement planning, and we have a legislative meeting with our lobbyists. And then I'm speaking at a Medicare conference that's in DC. So I'm going to be spending the rest of this week in DC, which is one of my favorite places in the country. Because like you, I mean, being a lawyer, it's just, you know, it's just got that thing that, you know, it hooks you in with what's actually going on in that power center. So I wish that I would have had that opportunity when I was an undergrad like you had, because that's pretty special and unique to get to see that in action.
Well, it's amazing that you're going back and you're that involved and really trying to make the change that's needed. And obviously you can do that in the court, and you can also do that from a legislative standpoint. So definitely appreciate your work on that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's part of our mission, obviously, you know, making sure injury victims are protected, and this is really part of that. It's got to do with making sure that their recoveries are protected, and you know, that's a super important part of what we do. And obviously, you know, after you've fought so hard for a client, you want to make sure ultimately that they're taken care of and they're protected, and that's what, you know, this is all about. So I love that, getting that opportunity, and two, being someone that experienced it myself, being struck by a car while I was cycling. You know, I've been through it, so I can speak directly to what it's like to have that happen to you and have your life upended. And
So I do think that it's a great opportunity for me to use that as a way to advocate for the people that we serve.
Yeah, and it provides you with that empathy too as to what they've been through. I hope you're doing okay. I see the cycling uniform in the back, so I imagine you've had some success doing it.
Yeah, I got back to it, although there's something that gets taken away from you, maybe a little bit of innocence or trust. You just become much more attuned to what's going on around you. And I had done it for a really long time. I started when I was a young kid. Although like you, I actually, the first sport I ever played was ice hockey. I started playing ice hockey when I was 5 years old because we were living in New Jersey. But when we moved to Florida, that sort of came to an end because at that time there wasn't even an ice rink in Orlando. Now that's changed. But I got into cycling as a teenager and competed at a pretty high level and loved the sport. But once you've been involved in something like that, it's hard to go about it without having some trepidation. I spent 9 days in the ICU. So,
Wow.
after an experience like that, you're definitely a bit more cautious.
Yeah,
Kind of as it is.
absolutely.
Well, so tell me what is at the heart of your passion for being a trial lawyer? I know you said you wanted to be a lawyer, from a very young age, but what is it that motivates you, gets you out of bed every day to do this and fight for people?
That's a great question. And having parents who immigrated here from Eastern Europe, my father from Hungary, my mom from Romania, and my mom sort of escaped a dictatorship, a communist dictatorship. And my father was much older, and he was affected by World War II and lost his son, and his mother-in-law was able to save his wife. And growing up as a kid, they would share these stories with me about what they went through, and just the level of injustice, unfairness, oppression, what they dealt with, really had an impact on me. And I know I'm not saving the world and doing that kind of thing, but something about a person who is being taken advantage of, especially when they're vulnerable. I think life is hard as it is. I would say for everybody, there are challenges, whether it's balancing work, a family, a career, trying to do these things. There's more than enough on our plate. And now imagine you've just suffered an injury, and sometimes it could be a rather innocuous one, but it's enough to have a very debilitating effect on your life. And I sort of joke, if everything was fair, you wouldn't need lawyers, right? If everything was just, you wouldn't need lawyers, because people would be compensated for what they've been through. So when you see somebody being treated unfairly, or not being compensated, or you've got some expert on the other side that is not giving the whole truth, or is misrepresenting the science or the medicine. I mean, I already have a fire lit in me, so it just makes it burn that much hotter. And it's that drive, I think, to really give people the voice, and then the dignity, and then the compensation that they deserve. I mean, it never goes away. You think maybe, oh, I'd get tired of this, and I don't. Every time I see something happen to a person that I'm advocating for, it just drives me to study their case, to basically reveal the truth, and then to tell their story if we end up going to a jury, to tell that story to our community.
Well, I've seen some of your impressive results handling catastrophic complex cases. I wanted to ask you about one case in particular because it jumped out at me. One, because as I told you, being a cyclist and being struck by a car, because the facts involve a cyclist that was struck, it was of note to me. So you obtained an incredible result. Can you talk about that case and why it was important?
Sure. This was back in 2018, and I think I lived in, so I'm out in the South Bay, Torrance, and we were in Orange County, and I did three trials back to back to back in the Orange County Superior Court, and this was the second of the three, and we represented a really, really nice kid. I mean, one of the sweetest kids I've ever met, and he was in his 20s, and he was riding home on a bicycle, no helmet, wearing flip-flops. I mean, he was from Hawaii, just a really carefree, sweet kid, and he was riding home, and he got hit by a car that was making a left, and ended up fracturing a vertebrae in his cervical spine. And sort of the impact, if you think about it, the way that it was fractured, that vertebrae, it was almost like a bomb or a grenade had gone off in his spine, and he had shrapnel. I mean, I think of it like shrapnel, but little fragments of the bone of the vertebral body just went flying and nicked a part of his spinal cord, several parts, and he was quadriplegic initially and made an amazing recovery, was back working within several months, but still had significant issues. I mean, you don't really fully recover from something like that, but he was just the spirit that he had was amazing. But you know, we go into Orange County, and you know, we're doing jury selection, and a lot of people that ride bicycles are thinking and saying, this would never happen to me. I would have, you know, I would have had a light on, or I would have had, you know, I would have been more careful. And there was a dispute because we had about four witnesses, and four witnesses means four different opinions, four different things about what they saw. Some people said he was on the sidewalk. Some people said he was on the street. Some people said he was, you know, riding like, you know, a demon, you know, you know, just going full throttle. Some people said he wasn't. And all these different takes on what happened that we had to deal with, and you know, people have biases naturally, right? A cyclist that rides on the sidewalk versus not, or that doesn't have a helmet, or does, or is wearing flip-flops, or you know, there's so many things. But at the end of the day, the one thing that hit me was you have four people from all these different perspectives at this intersection, and guess what? Even though they're saying a whole bunch of different things, there's one thing they're all saying, which is they saw him. They saw him before the impact. And the one person who actually had an obligation to see him was that driver making a left, right? So at the end of the day, this was sort of, to me, I was like, it was an aha moment. It was, look, this is, I'm not too worried about this. And this was something I had to talk about in jury selection. And you know, ironically enough, the people that are cyclists tend to be the hardest or the harshest on the person riding the bicycle, because they, you know, it's a feeling. I would never have put myself in that position. So that was one sort of big wrinkle that we were dealing with in that case. And another one was that the defendant actually passed away during litigation. So the defense, we were suing an estate, and the defense brought the wife, the widow of this defendant, and she looked, you know, very humble. And the jury, I had to talk to them about that. You know, who really feels, you know, uncomfortable that here we are suing an estate, and it's okay if you do. And so we had an effective jury selection, and we had a good judge, and you know, we were able to get a very good verdict for this young man, who's just, you know, like I said, a tremendous human being, and it was a tough, hard-fought battle, but we were able to help him out.
So aside from that case, are there any other cases that you've handled that you feel are important or influential?
I would say, you know, they're all, you know, I would say they're all important, and they're all influential, especially for the person that is experiencing that, right? But I do understand the, you know, the thrust of your question, and it was actually a case right after that, and I'd had very little time to prepare, and it was a products liability case, and I had a great co-counsel. And I think, you know, anytime you're trying cases, it's to do it by yourself is, I'd say almost impossible. You always have a team around you, and to be in trial by yourself is very challenging. And so, there's always somebody with me, whether it's somebody I'm co-counseling with or a member of my team. And this was a case against Suzuki. And my co-counsel was he's brilliant, and he knew the science behind it, and there was all sorts of chemistry and metallurgy as to how these pistons of a brake on these motorcycles were working. And it was all beyond me. But I said, look, if we talk to a jury about all of this science, don't you think a lot of this is going to get lost on them? I'm having a hard time, digesting all of it. And what's this case really about? How do we simplify it? And at the end of the day, Suzuki built a motorcycle and knew their brakes didn't work, and hid the fact that their brakes don't work to regulators, to the public, and continued to sell them. And really, that's the case. You got brakes that don't work. And I think cases like that, have the ability to change when you're, holding a company accountable, to change their behavior, to think twice about putting, profits, over safety. And it's that classic example of profits over safety, just like with the Pinto case. So products liability cases have that effect. And ultimately, we were able to obtain a verdict, and we had a client who suffered a broken patella in this motorcycle crash, and his brakes didn't work, and the jury awarded him just under $2 million, and then another $6 or $7 million in punitive damages against Suzuki. And that fight is still going on. I mean, there are other cases just like it. And again, keeping it simple, and you being a cyclist, right? Motorcycles are not too far from cyclists, and not too far from people's perception of it. I've never, rode a motorcycle. I'm not cool enough. I'm also a little bit scared to do that. I can understand why. And jurors on this case, felt the same way, and would say things like, he's a motorcyclist. He expect you got what you deserve. I mean, that's sort of the harsh things that you hear from jurors, but these are gifts, really. You want your jury, you want the community talking to you about these things, because you don't want some juror on there who doesn't, who's keeping this stuff inside, and then at the end of the day, you get a bad verdict, and they said, well, you should have never kept me on the jury. And jurors would say this, and I was taking it all in. I was not judging them, because you know what the truth is? There's a part of me that feels that way too, right? There's a part of that in all of us. And I talk to the jurors, and I just say, well, I get it. I don't ride motorcycles either. I think they're dangerous. But let me ask you this: what do you think would make them more dangerous? And I let them dwell on it for a minute, and I said, what if the brakes don't work? And what if you don't know that? And what if the company that sold you the motorcycle or made it hid that fact from you? And so you're sort of building your case in jury selection with these folks. So that was right after the bicycle case. I jumped right into that one, and we, another great outcome. So that was, we were happy for our client.
I was going to actually ask you, about the cases that you handle in the product liability realm and how do they improve society, but you answered that. It's funny because, sometimes when I'm talking to people that ask me about what I do and, I talk about the work that trial lawyers do to make our society a safer place and to hold, wrongdoers accountable. It's such a great example of what you described, a manufacturer making a product in such a way that it is defective and then hiding that. Or there was a recent article I saw about J&J, creating an entity basically to push cancer survivors who are making claims against them into bankruptcy proceedings, deliberately trying to limit compensation. And but for trial lawyers like you who go out and fight, these wrongdoers would just simply escape without being held accountable, and things don't change and things are less safe. But by these legal proceedings and taking on these types of fights, lawyers are doing us a huge service in making sure that, ultimately things are as safe as they possibly can be.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, when you're handling some cases like this, where they're a catastrophic injury case, what are the things that you do yourself, top three things to emphasize or to empathize, excuse me, with the clients to make sure that you can communicate their story to the jury to focus on what they've been left with after being injured?
Empathy is one of those things that I think is critical for life, just for being a good human being. Sympathy is kind of saying, "Hey, sorry you went through that." Whereas empathy is really putting yourself in the position of the other person. And I think it's important for any relationship, whether it's your spouse or your children or people you work with, and especially so when you're representing somebody. And the people that I represent sometimes are surprised how much I know about their lives, and I almost live it, if that makes sense. And I was exposed in high school to a little bit of theater, and some people say, "Well, are you acting?" No, but this idea of, tell that to Daniel Day-Lewis, right? Are you acting? But these people really embody what somebody's going through, and I think what I do is I try to find the person's story in myself. And I've represented somebody who was a young sort of, he was an MMA fighter, but he was somewhat of an entrepreneur in using social media, and this was the time when I was just starting my own firm, and I could really relate to how he was trying to build up his business and build a reputation in the community. So, one part of it is spending time with the person that you're representing, and learning how to love them. I think that's really critical. And a lot of personal injury lawyers will talk about some of the problems with their case. And I say, one of my mentors is a criminal lawyer. I say, go talk to a criminal lawyer and talk about problems with your case, So I would say the top three things is get to know the person you're representing, right? Spend time with them, break bread with them, listen to them, and then find that story within yourself. And at the same time, learn the facts of the case. Learn what they've been through, and make sure you have a good grasp of all of that. And I think those are sort of the foundational components to being able to empathize and then to tell their story.
Now, the reason I ask is empathy is one of our core corporate values here, and I use what I went through in my personal injury case to give people an idea of what clients have gone through when they wind up needing Synergy services, and as a way to try and hopefully allow those people to be empathetic and understand the opportunity and privilege we have to be a part of, hopefully improving their life in some small way, either by getting them more money in their pocket or protecting their recovery in some way or protecting their benefits, their government benefits. So, that concept of empathy, I think, is really important across all aspects of this area, from trial lawyers to the people that get the opportunity to work with clients after they've settled their cases, because it really is, someone that's vulnerable. They've been through something usually pretty devastating to their lives and could be to their families too. So making sure that we're doing everything we possibly can to understand that and do our best to improve their lives, for me, is really an important part of our mission and what we do every day.
Yeah, it's a great thing.
So I noticed that you got involved with the Spence Trial Lawyer College back in 2013. I was just curious about how you got involved and why that's important to you.
I actually heard the name Jerry Spence in college, in a social psychology book, and I loved social psychology. It was just a fascinating area of study, and I had read about him, and I thought this seems like a pretty amazing trial lawyer, and I learned a little bit more about him. And then when I graduated law school and I got a job, I had always wanted to I'd wanted to go learn from him. And it was 2013 that I went to the college for 3 weeks. And you know, Jerry's in his 80s at the time, and so you know, we didn't have that much exposure to him, but there were a lot of good instructors there that you know embodied what he would teach and how he would teach. And it was an experience where you know you're in Wyoming. You're not supposed to use a cell phone, or you're supposed to disconnect, right? And you're there for 3 weeks. And it's kind of nice to be able to disconnect from the world that we, you know, that we live in. And I'm not saying go be a transcendentalist like Rolf, or, you know, like, you know, was it, I can't think of the name right now, but Emerson, Waldo Emerson. I want to say, here I am bungling this. But I think disconnecting is a way to connect, right? That the sort of paradox of that is I think we need that as human beings, and this gave me an opportunity to do that and to learn a lot about myself. And this is sort of the one of the fundamental sort of components to what Jerry teaches and the folks there is that you know you have to really understand yourself in order to tell these stories about other people, and you have to be open with yourself, and you have to be vulnerable. And you have to recognize your own biases and the things that may actually be self-limiting in your ability to open up and be vulnerable with people. And so that was sort of a foundational lesson that I learned there. And I thought that, I mean, ultimately it changed the way that I practiced, the way that I tried cases. And I don't know if everyone has the same experience, but a lot of my colleagues or peers that have gone there have shared that sort of same sentiment, that's what it did for them. And I went back the year after, and I did a graduate program there. And then last year, I taught at the Jerry Spence Method, so we call it the ranch, going back there. So I had an opportunity to spend time with students and teach, and it was another just wonderful, wonderful experience in connecting with other trial lawyers. And you know, one of the things, and I think this happens in life, and especially as a trial lawyer, is you can feel like you're alone at times. I mean, you could talk to anybody, right? You could talk to somebody who's, you know, a mother who's having their first child or even their second, and trying to raise a child, and it can feel really lonely at times. And then once you start talking to other people that are going through the same thing, you realize, oh, we're not alone in this, and it's a very nice feeling. It's a way of connecting. It's a way of validation, and it's a way to gain strength through these processes and to learn from it. So it's a very human aspect of our existence, and it was great for me.
I also saw that you're involved with LATLC, and I'm very familiar with it. It's a wonderful organization. How are you involved with it, and why?
I got involved pretty early, and it was I became a board member, and now I'm sort of they've retired me to some extent. I'm an emeritus member, so it feels almost like you know the old professor. But the way that I got involved was just that they were out in the community, and so it wasn't just this organization where you're just donating money, although that is very important, you know. But it was literally going to a women's shelter in downtown Los Angeles and making food and serving food and spending time with these people. And sometimes, you know, we don't realize just the impact you can have on someone's life with something as simple as a smile, a warm hello, just listening to somebody, you know, giving them your ear. That can have a huge effect on somebody because it shows that, hey, there's somebody out there that cares. And LATLC was doing this and is doing this, and they're only growing and doing more and more of it. You know, and I just remember, you know, painting houses in Venice and trying to, you know, spruce them up, or you know, going to a after school kids program and spending time with kids. And so being able to actually be involved in the community and helping in the community, that's what really drew me towards this organization. And then it was trial lawyers that were, you know, we were doing it, which was cool. So I was there with my colleagues, all my fellow brothers and sisters who are trial lawyers, and we were there in the community, and it made it fun, and it was very rewarding. So, you know, something that I really love. I think there was even one time I dressed up as Clifford the Red Dog and had all sorts of face paint on me after. I mean, but it's fun, and it's just a very gives you a very warm feeling to be able to be involved in something like that.
Yeah, it's a great opportunity to give back and great organization from all the things I've seen that they do. And our not-for-profit foundation has been involved with that organization as well. So definitely love seeing the work that it does and the help that it provides to those people. So you've really built a pretty incredibly successful practice at a young age. What is one tip you would give other trial lawyers that's part of your secret to success in building your practice?
This is just my classic. It's hard work. it is at the end of the day, it is hard work, and I think sometimes you have to tune out the noise, you know, and you have to focus on what you believe is important, and sometimes that means making tough decisions, but I think at the end of the day, it goes back to some of the things we did already talk about, and it's treating people the right way. And I think that's just so important because we are a community, and it's a smaller community than a lot of people, you know. I mean, I think people know that, but you know, it's taking care of each other, it's being supportive of each other. I don't think that I could have built what I have built, and I don't think I would have had this success had it not been for countless other people who have supported me along the way, who have mentored me along the way, who have, you know, they have no reason. They never asked for anything in return. They just wanted to help me succeed. And so that's a big part of what I do, is I try to give back constantly the things that I learned and that I've gained from the experiences that I've had. So I'm constantly talking to other attorneys or to law students and sharing whatever I have. I think that's just so important to pay it forward so that we can, you know, make all of you, you know, all of us better at this and better, you know, better representatives, better human beings. Any way that we can do that. And I think that's just a big part of it is being supportive of one another, and being there for each other. I think that's just something to never lose sight of.
I mean, it's interesting the idea of relying on the community, right? There's so much power in that, and I've seen it, you know, on the listservs that I'm a part of with trial lawyers, that there really is this, you know, professionalism that, you know, extends to, well, you know, what can I do to help your practice? Even though there is some competitive nature for you guys, but still, it's, you know, you see it in, you know, when you go to these events, like if you go to Spence's Trial Lawyer College or you're, you know, working hand in hand at LATLC, I mean, all those things. So, you know, I think that's a little bit different from hard work. Obviously, hard work is what gets you there, but, you know, really having that ability to tap into the resources around you is pretty important. I know that's been very important in the kind of building what we've built here at Synergy as well.
Yeah, I think if you're a trialer, you're probably competitive. Or if you're running your own business, you probably are competitive, right? I mean, I see the cycling. We talked about your cycling, but I think it's a natural thing, and I think competition is good. People should be competitive, and it drives you to be better. And maybe it means you don't necessarily are looking at what the other person is doing, but just make sure you're getting better each day, right? Compete with yourself.
So a couple more questions. So just curious about your background. It says Bear Den. What is that?
So at some point, I don't know exactly when, I developed the sort of moniker or nickname Fair Bear. But I was probably a bit huskier at the time. I've never been a svelte guy. And my wife, when we first met, she called me Honey Bear. Since then, I've lost the honey part, unfortunately. So just Bear. But it's sort of been a name that stuck. And then my last name's Fair, and so it sort of just has a little ring to it. And I like it though, I like it for a couple reasons. But I think about just what I do, and there is a part of me, when we're dealing with the people that we represent, I do think, I'd like to see myself more as, that cuddly, nice teddy bear, right? And I think that part does come out, right? But then sometimes, when you're dealing with an insurance company or you're dealing with an expert that is not being truthful, it's okay to be a little grizzly. And I don't mean that. I don't mean, that you have to go and be mean or angry. I don't think those are the same things. But I think, it's a time where you have to, really go to battle. And I would actually, to other trial lawyers, I think a lot of them would agree. You definitely don't want to be the angry person in the courtroom. I don't think that's an effective way of cross-examining a witness. I think you're a lot more effective when you're there and you're calm and composed. And sort of anger, is an emotion that I think somewhat surface level, and really what's underneath anger is fear. So it's just being able to hold those two positions, right? You can definitely care a lot and take care of people, but when you need to go and be a warrior and go out to battle, and I know I'm using these sort of metaphors, but it can seem like a battle at times, you're able to do that. And I think that's important.
So now if you've got a few different areas of specialty, do you wind up co-counseling a lot of cases with other lawyers?
Yeah, a lot of our practice is other attorneys working with us and bringing us in to try cases with them. And we've really done a lot of, injury cases, and we started getting more and more cases that are outside of the world of personal injury and employment cases. Financial elder abuse cases, civil rights cases, even business cases where, you've got a big company and a sort of a mom and pop shop or a smaller company, and the big company's doing some bad stuff to the little company. And so, at the end of the day, one of the beautiful things about being a trial lawyer is you're here to tell a story about what happened, and something went wrong. Some trust was broken, or somebody did something really wrong, and it's not something that's only at the level or in the arena of personal injury. It's all over, right? And we experience wrongs in various aspects of our life, and so being able to tell that story, it's sort of these are universal stories, right? They're stories of humanity. I mean, the great the great stories that we read, or the movies that we see, or the poems that we read, right? They hit us because they touch upon something very basic. And so we've been very fortunate to have attorneys in the community who trust our ability to try cases and to understand the nuances of different areas of law. And so we've been brought on cases that are not personal injury related, and we've had some really good success with them. And at the end of the day, it's has somebody been wronged, and is there something that we can do to help make that right? And obviously there are things that may be outside of our wheelhouse, and we work with the appropriate experts. I mean, somebody may be a civil rights guru, and we're gonna work with them. Or somebody may be, just very, very well versed in probate matters, and you're dealing with testamentary capacity, or a trustee or power of attorney that has taken advantage of an elderly, man or woman, and has siphoned off millions of dollars of assets, right? And so, we always are looking to work together with, in a collaborative way with other attorneys, and we think that's what is sort of the most fun, right? Is being able to work with a team, having that synergy, feeding off of each other, inspiring each other to be creative in what we're doing, and then at the end of the day, all for a good cause.
So a couple more questions as we wrap up. Next one's a little self-serving, but I always ask it of our guests on the podcast. So when you're settling a personal injury case, what are the most difficult issues that you are facing? Is it lien resolution, Medicare-related issues, government benefits, how to protect the recovery? Just curious what you find challenging these days.
Liens are always something that can be a challenge, especially if you're dealing with ERISA liens, and or if you don't have a lien department. I mean, some of these firms are amazing. They've got lien departments, but for attorneys that I know when I just started out, it was me. So being able to work with others, like yourself, and I have the opportunity to do that. Has been helpful, right? Because sometimes it's just too much. And how we talked about this is a community, and we do rely on different people to help out that have an expertise in those areas. And I think negotiating liens can always be an issue, and we try to manage expectations. Obviously, when we have a recovery for a client, we want to make sure that the most amount of money, goes in their pocket. And lien resolution, whether it's, Medicare, Medi-Cal, ERISA, or it's a lien from a doctor, we want to be able to work out something that's fair for everybody. But that can be a challenge. It can hold up things at times. I do think that's one of the things. But right now, we're still not sort of back to normal, because of COVID. And one of the things that is challenging is not having firm trial dates, period, to get things resolved. So that, trial dates make insurance companies and corporations want to resolve things. So I'm looking forward to, for things to continue to move in the direction of getting back to where they were, and I do think we're headed there.
Yeah, we've definitely seen that the impact of COVID with trials not hanging over the heads of defendants, some of the cases that normally would have settled just haven't settled or have taken longer to settle. So, but like you said, hopefully it seems things are headed in the right direction, and we'll have to see how that plays out. Last question, and this is open-ended, so you answer it however you want. And since it's the Trial Lawyer View podcast, the question is, what is your view as a trial lawyer?
We have a great responsibility as trial lawyers to serve the people that we represent, and to do a good job. And we also, there's a there has been a pejorative or just, that trial lawyers are somehow, bad. I know that has been something in the community before, or that they're sue happy, and there's some negative connotations that go with it. And so I think it's our responsibility to do the work that shows that that's not the case. I mean, it's one thing, to speak about it, but it's a different thing to be about it, right? And so I think trial lawyers need to continue to be out there in the community, continue to make a difference, to help others, to help each other. It doesn't, do us any good when certain lawyers are not doing the right thing. And so we all have to lead by example. And I think, again, I love the, one of the themes of your company, which is empathy, and leading as much with love as possible. And I think that has to be a part of your life as a trial lawyer, and having the courage to stand up for the things that are right, and working with others constantly. I mean, I'm on the phone all the time asking for advice or giving advice, one or the other. I think it goes both ways. So I think there's just a great responsibility when you're a trial lawyer, and we should welcome that.
Great message to end on. Thanks for joining me today, Tom. Appreciate it. If somebody wants to get in touch with you, what is the best way to reach out to you?
I'm very even I'm always on my cell phone. That's the easiest way to get a hold of me, and you can text or call me. I'm sure my voicemail's always full, but that's the best way, and I have no problem giving it out. It's 818-522-8860, and that 818 area code is from a very long time ago, so I'm from the Valley and North Hollywood. Or email tom@fairlawfirm.com. I'm always happy to talk to anybody with any questions or help out any way I can.
We'll include all of Tom's contact information with this podcast episode when it's posted on the website. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to this episode of Trial Law Review, and see you on the next one.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to Trial Law Review. You can find more at triallawreview.com and look for more episodes and more content coming in the future.